spotlight. The $15.5 million price tag for the package didn't seem so terrific. But Sands had somehow managed to talk Webb down to a mere $1.1 million bribe in order to sign the new contract. Compared to the CONCACAF president's demands from the previous summer, that suddenly seemed like a downright bargain. Chapter 17. The Pact. With well over 100 million followers of the faith, Brazil is the world's largest Roman Catholic country. While still a Portuguese colony, all Brazilians were forced to pay taxes to the church, and well into the 19th century, priests were paid government salaries. Divorce wasn't legal in Brazil until 1977, when nearly 90% of the population still described itself as Catholic. On August 6, 1978, Pope Paul VI suffered a massive heart attack just after communion while staying at the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, and died 3 hours later. But the Pope's death also happened to fall on the same day as the semifinals of Brazil's professional soccer championship. And as it happened, the news reached Porto Alegre in the middle of a crucial match there between Internacional and Palmeiras, with José Ávila of TV Globo calling the action from the broadcast booth in Beira-Rio Stadium. Ávila, one of the nation's top commentators, paused from his patter for a report from one of his men on the sidelines. Internacional's fans are devastated to have just heard news over the loudspeaker of the Pope's death, the reporter said. But the man's handheld microphone betrayed him. Far from weeping and gnashing of teeth, television audiences instead heard the booming chants of more than 50,000 euphoric fans packed in the stands, desperately urging Internacional to victory and oblivious to the news. Ávila, too, was Catholic, but he didn't utter a single word in response. Without mentioning the Pope, he simply returned to his play-by-play without comment, and let the match come to its conclusion, a 1-1 tie that gave Palmeiras a pass to the finals. In Brazil, the one true religion is soccer, and the sport had been at the center of Avila's life for more than 50 years. It had shown him the world, helped him become friends with legends like Pelé, and provided his family with a lifestyle he could never have imagined as the son of a dairy farmer. He had fallen in love with the sport early, and it had consumed him with passion and excitement. But now he wanted out. Ávila was proud of what he'd built, but at the age of 69, the fun was long gone. Competition had grown much fiercer, margins had shrunk, and every year soccer officials grew bolder with their endless demands for bribes. On top of losing rights to most of the South American World Cup qualifiers, and being forced to sign a cost and revenue-sharing agreement with the little upstart media world to keep its hand in CONCACAF's World Cup qualifiers, traffic had also lost ground at home. In August 2012, Ávila had been obliged to sign another collaboration agreement, this time with a former associate who had left traffic and promptly stolen away rights to the Copa do Brasil, the country's top-level professional league, by offering millions of dollars in bribes to three of the country's top soccer officials. Traffic had held those rights since 1990, and Ávila saw little choice but to join up with his former friend. Gritting his teeth, he agreed to help pay the bribes for the next decade in exchange for half the profits from the deal. The headaches hardly stopped there. Traffic's investment in a second-tier American professional soccer league, the NASL, was hemorrhaging more cash every year as franchises faced low attendance and teetered on the edge of insolvency. The clubs Ávila owned in Portugal and Brazil didn't make any money either. A huge training ground he had built 2 hours outside of São Paulo wasn't working out. And a youth soccer academy that was supposed to turn out star players Traffic could represent was mismanaged and a money loser. Then there were the newspapers. Harking to his journalistic past, Ávila bought his hometown paper, Folha de Rio Preto, for roughly $2.5 million in 2005, and 4 years later bought the metropolitan daily, Diario de S. Paulo, for 100 million reals, or about $50 million. By late 2012, he owned 6 Brazilian dailies, and like traditional papers all around the world in the Internet age, they were in a death spiral. Avila had cut costs, consolidated offices, and in a painful last resort, laid off reporters, but all to no avail. As far as he could reckon, the newspapers had a value of approximately nothing. The only saving grace was the TV stations. Avila owned 4, plus a production studio, and they were highly profitable. He figured they were worth north of $160 million, making them by some stretch his most attractive asset. As for the rest of it, all of traffic, he would happily sell and walk away from football once and for all. He had tried to get out before. In 1999, Avila unloaded 49% of traffic to Dallas investment fund Hicks Muse, but had gotten back full ownership just a few years later in exchange for his half-share of a joint venture that controlled rights to the Copa Libertadores, a popular annual South American professional tournament. Then in 2008, the French media conglomerate Largardère had come calling, offering $280 million for traffic and the production studio, only to pull out when the global financial crisis hit. Now Avila was eager to be done with it, to walk away and enjoy his grandchildren. Officially, he told potential buyers the price was $200 million, but in truth, he'd accept $100 million just to be done. But no less than that. Though he was already very wealthy, he still wanted to squeeze as much as he could out of traffic. The problem was that traffic's value depended on the rights contracts currently in its portfolio. Every single deal he lost took away from the company's worth, which in great part was why he was willing to join forces with rival sports marketing firms such as Media World. But even with the Central American qualifiers and the Copa do Brasil back in hand, Avila still had little to say to would-be buyers about traffic losing its most valuable asset of all. Since 1987, the Copa America had been the company's great prize. It had netted almost $30 million in profit from the 2007 edition alone. It had been nearly a year since Avila had sued Full Play and CONMEBOL in Miami over their blatant theft of his rights, and the dispute was showing no sign of wrapping up soon. If anything, it was getting more heated. Avila's New York lawyers had hired private investigators to dig into the financial affairs of South American soccer officials, pushing his relations with the Confederation to a new low. Just 2 years earlier, a huge party had been thrown in honor of Traffic's 30th anniversary at the fashionable Hotel Unique in Sao Paulo, and Avila had been toasted in front of some 300 people by no less than Pelé himself. The most powerful man in Brazilian soccer, Rio de Janeiro Daily O Globo had called him on the occasion. But now, Avila felt trapped, held hostage to what he privately called a band of thieves. If he wanted to preserve traffic's value so it could be sold at all, he had no choice but to continue paying bribes to crooked soccer officials. The whole of soccer seemed rotten to him, and he had begun to feel distinctly like a victim of the very industry he played a pioneering role in creating. In mid-October, Avila flew to Punta del Este to go over some details of the wedding of his baby boy. Rafael Avila and his striking fiancée, the daughter of a prominent Sao Paulo lawyer, were getting married on November 17th and wanted their big day to stand out. The party would stretch over several days, including gourmet meals at local eateries, a rehearsal dinner at Uruguay's top-rated restaurant, a beach ceremony for 700 guests beneath a custom-made canopy, a day-after poker tournament, and custom gift bags that included colorful silk scarves bearing the nicknames of the bride and groom. There were a ton of details to coordinate, and the costs were commensurate with an event that aspired to be Wedding of the Year. The final bills weren't in, but when all was said and done, the whole thing would likely cost more than $1 million. Unlike Stefano, Avila's older son, Rafael had steered clear of the soccer business. Concerning himself with Rafael's happiness allowed Avila to stop fretting over traffic and the deplorable state of his business affairs. Traveling to Uruguay and resolving wedding problems felt like being sprung momentarily from a trap that he had unwittingly set for himself all those years back, when he bought a little bus stop advertising company called Traffic. And then, while in Punta del Este, Avila's phone rang. On the line was Hugo Hincas, the owner of Full Play. He had heard Avila was in town, and, as it happened, so was he. They should get together, Hincas said, to talk about the Copa America. The soccer world is not so big. There are only so many tournaments, congresses, and championships, and eventually everyone gets to know one another to a greater or lesser degree. Hincas and Avila weren't by any means close, but they did have friends in common, and one of them had recently put them in a room together in Rio de Janeiro to try to resolve the dispute. In the Rio meeting, Hincas had complained that Avila's lawsuit was becoming an increasingly large headache. The legal fees for a dispute litigated in U.S. courts were exorbitant, and in any case it was making it extremely difficult for Hincas to begin selling commercial rights for the 2015 Copa America. Sponsors didn't want to touch it if there was a risk that an injunction could blow the whole tournament up. If the court fight went on much longer, Hincas feared, it could effectively gut the value of the tournament from his perspective. So he proposed forming a partnership to share the tournament, much as Avila had done with Media World, and his former associate in Brazil. If Avila agreed to drop the lawsuit, Hincas would cut him in on the tournament all the way through 2023. But Hincas also added an unexpected wrinkle. It would be a three-way split. The third participant, he said, would be Torneos y Competencias, an Argentine sports marketing firm that had, years earlier, been Avila's partner in the Copa Libertadores, and still managed the rights to that tournament. Avila couldn't understand why Hincas wanted to cut in another company, and flatly refused. From his perspective, the Copa America had been unjustly stolen from him, and it was already humiliating enough to have to negotiate with someone he privately regarded as a thief. Why should he be forced to share it with yet another rival? But as time passed and the lawsuit dragged on, it was becoming increasingly apparent that without the Copa America in Traffic's portfolio, there just wasn't much interest from prospective buyers. So when Hugo Hincas called him in Uruguay, Avila agreed to meet again. The Argentine's proposal hadn't budged. He still wanted to include Torneos y Competencias, and asked if he'd please consider a third meeting, this time with the chief executive of that firm, Alejandro Berzaco, who happened to be in Uruguay as well. Avila reluctantly agreed. Berzaco had made a fortune in banking and private equity before giving it up to get into the soccer business. He was extremely charismatic, and he and Hincas, aware of Avila's reluctance, offered up a tantalizing sweetener when they all got together. They'd been talking to South American soccer officials about a potentially very lucrative idea, they said, one that had bounced around for years, but never gotten any traction. A special edition of the Copa America, celebrating 100 years of the tournament, to be held in the United States in 2016. Chuck Blazer had always blocked the notion out of concern that it would cannibalize the Gold Cup. But now that Enrique Sanz was firmly ensconced as Traffic's inside man at CONCACAF, there would finally be the opportunity to make the tournament happen. They'd call it the Copa America Centenario, Hincas and Borzaco said, noting that they already had buy-in from the key South American officials. Imagine, the biggest stars from South America, including Argentina's Leo Messi, Uruguay's Luis Suarez, and Brazil's Neymar, playing in Chicago, Miami, New York. Sponsors and broadcasters would be clamoring for a piece of the action. The profits could be huge. Was he interested? Yes, Avila finally admitted. He was considerably more than interested. Chapter 18. The Warner Brothers. When federal law enforcement agents become interested in people as targets of an investigation, there are a number of ways to keep tabs on them. The best known is electronic surveillance, commonly known as a wiretap. With a warrant procured under Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968, agents can bug a person's landline or cell phone, peruse her faxes and text messages, listen to her voicemail, read every single one of her emails, and scroll through her Facebook chats and Instagram direct messages, without the suspect being the wiser. Unhappily for the feds, Title III warrants aren't easy to get. Judges make prosecutors jump through considerable hoops before issuing one. They must prove there is probable cause a crime has been committed, and describe what laws they think were broken. They have to identify whom they are targeting, and most burdensome of all, attest in extensive detail to the fact that they have already unsuccessfully tried every other possible means to gather evidence. Wiretaps are meant as a last resort, and even when they're granted, they can be a pain. Among other things, they require huge amounts of manpower in the form of agents sitting round the clock in a dark and airless wire room, listening to every call in real time. But there are other tools available that, while less invasive than a wire, are far easier to procure. On September 11, 2012, a third prosecutor assigned to the soccer case, Darren Laverne, filed a sealed application for a pen register and trap and trace device to be put on three South Florida mobile phones belonging to Darian and Daryl Warner. Pen registers provide a rolling list of all incoming and outgoing calls tied to a particular phone number and can also be used on email. Although they don't capture the actual contents of the communications, they can help investigators gain a better sense of whom suspects talk to and how often, a particularly useful thing when trying to understand elaborate criminal organizations. Pen registers are also easy to get, as federal judges generally sign them without substantial review. In the case of the Warners, the pen register application made no mention of soccer or the larger themes of the investigation, only that the Eastern District was conducting an ongoing criminal investigation into possible violations of federal criminal laws. A magistrate in Brooklyn granted it for 60 days without comment. With the pen register in place, the investigators would receive constant updates on every call the Warner Brothers made, which, with any luck, would help them zero in on the real target, their father. Bringing in Chuck Blazer had been a terrific coup. But short of Sepp Blatter himself, Jack Warner seemed just about the most important person the feds could possibly bring in. He had been the president of CONCACAF for 21 years, a member of FIFA's Exco for almost 29, and an official of the Caribbean Football Union for even longer. There was almost no one in world soccer who hadn't crossed Warner's path. And given his apparent proclivity for graft, bribery, and outright theft, he doubtless had enough dirt stored in his brain and filing cabinets to bring a roaring RICO indictment home in no time. Blazer had regaled the prosecutors in extensive detail about Warner's corrupt acts, including the bribes he took for his World Cup votes, and he'd also provided documentary evidence. But getting to Warner wouldn't be so easy as simply proving he had committed a crime. 5 months earlier, Warner had been named Trinidad and Tobago's Minister of National Security, an extremely powerful cabinet position putting him in charge of the nation's police and fire service, army, air force, coast guard, prisons, and immigration department. Even if the prosecutors wanted to request information about Warner from Trinidad or formally petition for his arrest at the U.S. government's behest, the entreaty would, bizarrely, probably have to cross Warner's own desk first. Travel records showed that Warner came to the United States from time to time, but he was a high-level official from a foreign government, and traveled on a diplomatic passport, which conferred immunity. He could not be arrested, detained, subpoenaed, searched, or prosecuted. Jack Warner, in other words, was untouchable. but his sons were not. By the time Warner's first son, Darian, was born in 1968, Jack Warner had already committed to a life in soccer. 5 years earlier, he had been elected General Secretary of the Central Football Association, a regional soccer organization in Trinidad's complex network of amateur leagues, and was a delegate to the country's national federation. Darryl, his second son, was born in 1974, as Warner was mounting a successful campaign for the federation's secretary, a position he would hold for 16 years until taking over CONCACAF. As his soccer career flourished, Warner traveled incessantly, seeing little of his sons and leaving the job of raising them to his wife, Maureen. She abided his absences and kept the family together, while her husband played almost no role in the upbringing of Darian and Darryl. The boys, in turn, rarely complained. Darian was the bright one. He earned an undergraduate business degree at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, a master's at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and did postgraduate work in Australia and South Korea. He spoke Korean and some Spanish, had his hands in a number of businesses, and enjoyed day trading stocks. His kid brother more strongly resembled their father, with the same wide-set eyes, broad smile, and gap between his two front teeth. But Darryl was something of a mother's boy, less academically inclined, and seemingly devoid of the entrepreneurship that drove Darian. Despite their differences, one thing united them: doing Dad's bidding. Darian was the registered owner of a professional soccer club his father founded in Trinidad, and a manager of the travel agency his father ran. Darryl had for several years been a FIFA development officer in the Caribbean, and both sons were listed as directors of numerous companies started by their father. It was Darian who in 2006 sold World Cup tickets acquired by his father through FIFA for a huge markup. And when FIFA hired the auditor, Ernst & Young, to investigate the matter, he was entrusted to cover up the evidence, take the fall, and ensure that his father wasn't implicated. 4 years later, Darryl chipped in to help his father get more World Cup tickets for Darian to scalp, ignoring warnings from FIFA that the practice was forbidden. That was the deal in the Warner clan. Soccer was the family business, and everyone was expected to participate. Dad was the boss, providing the brains and political influence, while Darian and Darryl were the soldiers, doing the odd jobs and, when problems arose, standing in front of the bullets so that their father remained unscathed. Not long after formally joining the case, Steve Berryman checked to see if there were suspicious activity reports on any suspects. Known in law enforcement as an SAR, the reports are filed by employees of banks and other financial service providers to alert regulators to behavior that could indicate any number of economic crimes, particularly money laundering. It was routine, something Berryman did on every case, and it was often a gold mine. This time was no different. In July 2011, a teller at a J.P. Morgan Chase branch in Midtown Manhattan filed an SAR after processing a cash deposit from Darian Warner. He had come to the window with 7,500 euros in cash, intending to deposit it at his account at the bank. But after being informed that under that day's exchange rate, the deposit was equivalent to $10,636.50, Warner did something odd. He asked for 500 of the euros back, bringing the total to $9,336.60. To a trained teller, that looked highly suspicious. Under federal law, banks are required to file a currency transaction report to regulators for all cash deposits over $10,000. People who wish to avoid such government scrutiny often purposely make deposits just below that amount, breaking large sums of money into dozens of small transactions. The practice is known as structuring, or more colorfully, smurfing, a term allegedly inspired by the image of an army of little blue men making hundreds of small deposits all at once. It is illegal and by deliberately reducing his deposit to come in below that threshold, Warner had inadvertently given the teller the impression he was trying to hide structuring. The SAR detailing the teller's concerns was a very exciting find for Berryman. Soon, the IRS agent had gotten a lock on many of the U.S. bank accounts belonging to Dorian Warner and other members of his family, and had begun subpoenaing for the underlying account information. He had also figured out that the Warners flew almost exclusively on American Airlines, which had several nonstop flights a day between Miami and Port of Spain, and so he pulled the carrier's flight records as well. With all those documents spread before him, Berryman could begin to see a crystal-clear and highly unlawful narrative emerge. Spotting structuring was an IRS agent's bread and butter, as easy and routine as writing a speeding ticket for a highway patrolman. Berryman had a good idea of what the Warners had been doing. Now it was just a matter of proving it down to the last detail. So, throughout much of 2012, Berryman undertook the laborious task of gathering evidence, tracking down deposit tickets and bank surveillance camera video, interviewing tellers, and getting handwriting analysis to verify that the signatures he found did indeed belong to Dorian and Darryl Warner. It was meticulous, grindingly slow work, and Berryman loved it. It was exactly the kind of thing he relished for its completeness, for its elegance, for the fact that it didn't rely on anything except rock-solid documentary evidence. He determined to the minute when the deposits were made. He had photos of the Warners making them, courtesy of the cameras on ATMs. And, thanks to an interview with the teller at the Chase branch in New York, he had evidence proving intent. By intentionally reducing the size of his deposit to come in below $10,000, Warner displayed clear knowledge of the law he was shirking. The Warners had clearly been structuring for years, but Berryman decided to zero in on a 5-month window starting soon after Warner resigned from all his positions in world soccer. In that stretch of time, Berryman found Dorian and Darryl traveled to New York, Frankfurt, Aruba, Las Vegas, Colombia, Jamaica, London, Prague, St. Petersburg, Guadalajara, and Dallas. Sometimes they traveled together, sometimes alone. In almost every case, they'd stop for a few days in Miami before heading back to Port of Spain. Nearly every time they set foot in the U.S., the Warner brothers would make a beeline to a bank branch or ATM to deposit cash. Mostly it was dollars, but also euros, rubles, and pounds. Berryman isolated 112 discrete cash deposits of less than $10,000 into 10 different accounts at American banks, made in the course of all those trips, amounting to a grand total of $619,563.70. On August 29, 2011, for example, the two Warners got off an American Airlines flight from Aruba to Miami, and within a few hours, made deposits of $8,954.82 and $8,210.77 into accounts held by Darryl at Bank of America and Citibank. Darryl returned to Trinidad the next day, while his older brother flew a few days later to Las Vegas, where he made three separate deposits of $9,900 apiece into accounts at Chase and Citibank, before returning to Miami, depositing $9,950 into a Chase account, $9,900 into a Bank of America account, and $9,800 and $9,900 into a Wells Fargo account. Finally, on September 7th, he deposited $9,950 at Chase, $9,800 at Citibank, $9,920 at Bank of America, and $9,960 at Wells Fargo, all in Miami and Coral Gables. In the space of 10 days, the brothers had deposited just over $126,000 in cash into seven different accounts at four different American banks. Looking at all the deposit records he'd gathered, Berryman reminded himself that Warner's soccer days were over when all of this happened. He was a government minister earning a public employee's salary in Trinidad. It was not hard to wonder where all that cash was coming from. Miami's waterfront is lined with soaring residential skyscrapers, glittering generic monuments to newly acquired international wealth jutting straight up from sea level. Over the past 15 years, billions of dollars have streamed into these buildings, which seem to sprout like sawgrass as foreign investors use the real estate market to convert foreign currency into dollars and safely park them in the U.S. The Skyline Condominium in the Brickell neighborhood, about a mile and a half south of downtown Miami, is as good an example as any of what might be called the South Florida Foreign Exchange School of Architecture, which prizes speed of construction over any pretensions of artistic expression. The white and blue tower, completed in 2004, is 35 stories high and commands sweeping views of Biscayne Bay. It has a doorman, private marina, swimming pool, beach volleyball court, gym and valet parking, features that make the edifice almost indistinguishable from the towers to either side of it. In late 2005, Darrell Warner bought a three-bedroom penthouse in the Skyline for $990,000, financing the purchase with a mortgage that he applied for using false information about his employment, residence, income, and assets. He affirmed to the lender that he'd pay the $300,000 down payment from his own accounts, thus establishing that he was the sole purchaser. But in fact, two-thirds of the money came from a cashier's check drawn on the account of a company belonging to his older brother, with the remaining $100,000 from an account in the name of the CONCACAF Center of Excellence. Late on the night of Tuesday, November 20th, 2012, Steve Berryman sat in a car parked outside the Skyline, staring up at Warner's unit and watching to see if all the lights had finally gone out. Several weeks earlier, Jared Randall had received an automated alert from a Customs and Border Protection database that tracks the entry of every person coming into the country by air or sea. Law enforcement agents can submit names to watch out for, and as soon as one of those people so much as books an airline ticket, it alerts the system, triggering an automatic email. As the team expanded the scope of its investigation, its border watch list had grown large, and alerts arrived with increasing frequency as global soccer officials came in and out of the country. Pending arrivals represented possible opportunities, provoking long discussions between Norris and Berryman about the benefits of serving a subpoena at the airport, for example, or trying to corner someone else and get them to flip. But because of their overriding concerns about preserving the case's secrecy, most alerts came and went with no action taken at all. This one was different. Jack Warner was flying into Miami for Thanksgiving, and his wife and both sons were going to be there as well. It was the opportunity the investigators had been waiting for. Heart surgery had put Berryman out of commission for almost 3 weeks. Since returning to work, his heart had gone into atrial fibrillation several times, terrifying episodes that made him think he might have a stroke at any moment. When he flew to New York from California early that week, he was still so weak that he couldn't lift his suitcase off the luggage carousel without asking a stranger for help. But early on November 20th, Berryman put on a suit and tie and appeared before a United States magistrate judge in Brooklyn Federal Court to swear to a sealed criminal complaint against Darian and Darrell Warner, then hopped on a flight to Miami and staked out the condo until he was sure everyone was asleep, what agents call putting a target to bed. About an hour before sunrise the next morning, Berryman met up with Randall, two local FBI agents, and two Miami-based IRS agents in a church parking lot. Mike Gaeta, as the C-24 squad supervisor, had largely been absent from day-to-day work on the case, occupied instead with overseeing the numerous different investigations his agents were working simultaneously. But he'd made the trip down as well. This was important. All of the agents wore bulletproof vests and nylon windbreakers with FBI or IRS-CID police printed in oversized letters on the back. They drove to the Warner's building together, parked in the underground garage, and rode the elevator up to the lobby, where a security guard accompanied them to a second high-speed elevator, turning a key in the control panel to prevent the lift from making any unwanted stops. The seven federal agents paused at the penthouse's black door to unholster their sidearms, letting the weapons hang at their side. Then Gaeta, arrest warrants in hand, knocked. It was barely 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving Eve, and the building was completely quiet. As they waited, the agents stood in the carpeted hallway, bathed in the silence, eyes wide. Finally, Darian, short like his father but more muscular, with bulging biceps, a boyish face, and hints of gray in his hair, swung open the door, groggy from sleep. "FBI," Gaeta barked. "You're under arrest." Darian let the agents in and they spread around the apartment, going from room to room to ensure there were no weapons, before returning and putting their pistols back in their holsters. By then, the entire Warner family was in the living room, stunned looks on their faces. The brothers needed to dress and fetch their passports, Gaeta said. And while they did, perhaps Dad would be amenable to a nice little chat. As the other agents accompanied Darian and Daryl to their bedrooms, Randall, Berryman, and Gaeta took a seat at the dining room table, along with Jack Warner. If they couldn't arrest the man, then maybe they could bust his kids in front of him and shock him into flipping. That was the big plan, and it was why Gaeta had made the trip to Miami. He was the talker, the one who had made a career out of converting hardened Genovese wise guys into stool pigeons. He had started this case 2 years earlier, and now, with any luck, he was going to take a huge step toward closing it. "We would like to talk to you about helping us," Gaeta began, his New York diction seeming to thicken in the tense atmosphere. "This is your chance to come clean and fix things." He wanted to know it all, he said, about the bribes, about Russia and Qatar winning the World Cup, about the tickets, the offshore companies, and about Sepp Blatter. "You promised a tsunami," Gaeta said, referencing Warner's oft-quoted statements prior to his resignation from FIFA. "We want to know all about the tsunami." "Where," Warner responded, "are you taking my sons?" It was as if the two men were talking past one another, making eye contact but not really listening. As Gaeta grew more animated, laying his New York accent on stronger, Warner seemed to stiffen, and his high-pitched Trinidad drawl grew more pronounced. His initial jumpy nervousness faded, and his narrow features progressively hardened. Warner was much tougher than anyone had guessed. "This is your chance," Gaeta repeated, "to come clean." By then, Warner had his cell phone in his hand, and seemed increasingly eager to use it. "I'll think about it," Warner said, his eyes focusing now and filling with cold fury. "I'll get an attorney." It was over. The conversation had lasted less than 10 minutes. Warner wasn't biting. By then, Darian and Daryl were ready to go. The agents stood, disappointed looks on their faces. They read the brothers their Miranda rights, placed handcuffs on their wrists, then escorted them out of their penthouse, down to the garage, and drove to the FBI's drab two-story field office in North Miami Beach. By the time they got there, Jack Warner had retained lawyers for his sons. Hours later, Darian and Daryl flew to New York, accompanied by Randall and several other agents, while Berryman stayed behind in Miami to interview a few more bank tellers about deposits the Warners had made. The case he had made against them was strong. By structuring more than $100,000 in under a year's time, each brother faced up to 10 years in prison, on top of significant fines. They had little choice but to cooperate, and before the month was out, they, like Blazer, would be proffering to the prosecutors in Brooklyn in hopes of winning a lighter sentence. Norris and the others had viewed Warner as a key to the entire case, and had spent months strategizing about how best to reel him in before coming up with what seemed like a winning plan. But the wily Trinidadian had looked his antagonists straight in the eye, and he had not blinked. The day after his devoted sons were arrested right in front of him, Warner flew back to the safe confines of his native Trinidad, far out of reach. Chapter 19. A Sad and Sorry Tale. Early in 2008, a federal grand jury in Brooklyn handed down a massive indictment targeting 62 members of the Gambino, Genovese, and Bonanno crime families. And in a series of takedowns in New York, New Jersey, and Sicily, federal agents made dozens of arrests. The Gambinos were particularly targeted, with 54 members of the family arrested, and eventually an entire generation of Gambino leadership went to prison. The operation had been a resounding success, splashed across the front pages of the tabloids, which prosecutors proudly cut out, framed, and hung on the walls of their offices. But the arrests and subsequent convictions did not fully dismantle the Gambino family business. Instead, with the old bosses out of commission, new leadership quickly stepped forward to take over, forming a 3-man panel to secretly oversee the syndicate's criminal activities. In January 2011, agents unleashed an even bigger takedown, arresting some 125 people based on 16 different indictments. All three members of the Gambino crime family's new ruling panel were picked up. And in March of 2013, Norris temporarily left the soccer case to try one of them, a longtime mobster named Bartolomeo Vernace, handing the reins to Amanda Hector and Darren Laverne. On April 17th, after an exhausting 5-week trial, Norris won convictions on RICO, narcotics, gambling, loan sharking, robbery, firearms, and murder charges, and Vernace was eventually sentenced to life without parole. But once again, the arrests and convictions did not fully dismantle the family business. Long before Vernace's reckoning, another wise guy, Domenico Cefalù, had stepped up as the new Gambino boss. That was how it worked, fighting organized crime. No sooner did you bust one generation of crooks than you were chasing after the ones that came up behind them. On April 19th, 2013, Sir David Simmons, former Chief Justice of Barbados, faced the CONCACAF Congress in the Westin Playa Bonita in Panama to announce the results of the lengthy internal investigation of the administration of Jack Warner and Chuck Blazer. Working for the Confederation's Integrity Committee, Sidley Austin's lawyers and a team of accountants had interviewed 38 witnesses, reviewed 4 terabytes of data, and pored over reams of bank records, emails, and other correspondence. Their conclusion, Simmons said, was that CONCACAF's prior leadership had misappropriated funds and committed fraud. Warner and Blazer had run the Confederation entirely at their convenience for their illicit profit and should be condemned. The 144-page final report, which had not previously been public, laid out as a breathtaking narrative of self-interest, incomplete disclosure, and outright theft. Between his 10% contract, other fees, and liberal use of the Confederation's expense accounts to pay for his lifestyle, including rent, Blazer had skimmed an astonishing $20.6 million from the Confederation between 1996 and 2011, the investigation found. He had put the soccer body at risk by failing to file its tax returns, and had caused it to buy numerous properties that were for his benefit alone. Warner, meanwhile, had abused his presidency to secretly take ownership of the Center of Excellence, thus appropriating for himself roughly $26 million in funds that belonged to CONCACAF, including $462,200 sent from Australia's Soccer Federation in connection with its 2022 World Cup bid. Warner had even set up secret bank accounts that only he controlled, in the name of the CONCACAF Center of Excellence, that received deposits directly from FIFA that went to his benefit alone. "I have recounted a sad and sorry tale in the life of CONCACAF," Simmons said, "a tale of abuse of position and power by persons who assisted in bringing the organization to profitability, but who enriched themselves at the expense of their very own organizations." After the presentation, Jeffrey Webb, flanked by Sepp Blatter and Enrique Sanz, summoned reporters so he could loudly pronounce his disapproval. "Members are obviously very disappointed, some of them deeply disappointed," Webb said. "They have a right to be." Webb had been the Confederation's president for only 10 months, but he was already a star in the soccer world. In late February, Webb had been named the Cayman Islands Person of the Year, and in early March, Sepp Blatter appointed him chairman of FIFA's new Anti-Racism and Discrimination Task Force. Still just 48 years old, Webb was one of seven FIFA vice presidents, and an increasingly in-demand public speaker and ambassador of the sport. Rumors began to spread that he might someday replace Blatter as president of the entire organization. He talked repeatedly with the leadership of South America's Confederation about their idea for a Copa America Centenario, and he'd spent several days prior to the Panama Congress escorting Blatter and FIFA General Secretary Jerome Valk on a tour of the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and finally Cuba, where they had a face-to-face meeting with Raul Castro himself. Everywhere he went, he touted the reforms he was making. Indeed, Webb had made changes, considerable ones. But rather than cleaning up the sport, they seemed directed at surrounding himself with people who were loyal only to him, and would protect his growing book of illicit activities. Right off the bat, Webb brought in Sands, his nexus with traffic, and the rich bribes that relationship promised. It was a remarkably brazen choice, one that put Webb's personal interests ahead of the Confederation's, and a clear indication of how he viewed the role of president. An opportunity to grab as much gold as he could. Sands's opportune placement was mutually beneficial, of course, giving Traffic a massive edge over competitors, since Sands, working with Webb, could shut out all other sports marketing firms. The arrangement eerily echoed the one forged more than 35 years earlier, at the dawn of modern sports marketing, when Coca-Cola and Adidas inserted young Sepp Blatter into FIFA as a development officer, ensuring their monopolization of soccer for years to come. Next, Webb created the Integrity Committee to air out the stench of the prior administration, sending $2 million of the Confederation's cash to Sidley Austin to produce its damning report, an expenditure that came on top of the law firm's generous monthly billings. In October, he formed an Audit and Compliance Committee, ostensibly charged with the critical task of reviewing the Confederation's books to ensure that no more financial abuses took place. But he made sure natives of the Caribbean outnumbered all others on the panel, among them a close friend from Cayman. In December, Webb formed a nine-man finance committee, chaired by a Jamaican power broker and a staunch supporter of Webb. That panel, too, had a Caribbean majority, including another of his friends from home. Webb also created an integrity office, charged with monitoring corruption and particularly with rooting out what was rumored to be rampant match-fixing in CONCACAF, particularly in the Confederation's Central American countries, which had been targeted by gambling syndicates. Yet the office's director soon discovered that Webb had no intention of actually implementing any of her reforms, and eventually he stopped speaking to her altogether. In January 2012, Webb pushed a Panamanian official off the Confederation's executive committee and replaced him with Eduardo Lee, a Costa Rican who had headed his country's soccer federation since 2007. Unlike the Panamanian, Lee was loyal to Traffic and had a tight relationship with Enrique Sanz. In 2009, he had rejected an offer from Media World to purchase Costa Rica's World Cup qualifier rights, instead accepting one from Traffic. During negotiations, Sanz, still with the sports marketing firm at the time, had agreed to pay him a six-figure bribe. Chuck Blazer had long ago announced that he would not seek another term on the FIFA Exco after his current term expired, and Webb made it clear he wanted Sunil Gulati, the U.S. Soccer Federation president, to win that coveted open seat. Gulati had been one of Webb's more vocal supporters, and had set him up with the lawyers at Sidley Austin. There was considerable opposition within the membership to Gulati's candidacy, however, since many saw him as tainted by his well-known and long-running friendship with Blazer. Such attitudes would be unfair, Webb told the Confederation's delegates. I would hope, and I would think, that our membership is much more mature and beyond that. Thanks to a decisive vote from the tiny Caribbean nation of Anguilla, Gulati was narrowly elected. And in the final agenda item of the Congress, Webb convinced the membership to let five new full members into the Confederation. French Guiana, Guadeloupe, Martinique, St. Martin, and Sint Maarten. Yet more Caribbean members would only further solidify Webb's grip on CONCACAF. Webb still drew no salary and made a public show of that fact as some kind of testament to his purity. But his lifestyle was increasingly extravagant, thanks in large part to the bribes and kickbacks that kept flowing in. On December 14th, for example, the last $500,000 chunk of the money Traffic had secretly agreed to pay Webb for the CFU deal hit Kostas Takis' bank account in Cayman. Takis turned around and sent part of the bribe to one of his own Miami accounts. Some of that cash was then transferred to the account of a local contractor who was preparing to install a swimming pool in an 8-bedroom mansion Webb had bought outside Atlanta. And when a bank official inquired about the purpose of the wire, Takis said it was a wedding present for Webb. Another dollop was transferred to an account at SunTrust Bank in Georgia, which Webb used to expand his real estate holdings in the area. On January 13th, Webb closed on a 3-bedroom, 1,500-square-foot place in Conyers, Georgia, for $64,000. Then, on February 15th, he bought another piece of Georgia real estate, paying $140,000 for a 4-bedroom brick structure in the town of Stone Mountain that had been in foreclosure. Chuck Blazer was still talking to the prosecutors, and Darian and Daryl Warner were deep into their proffers as well. But those cooperators could only tell stories about the past. They knew nothing about what came after them. CONCACAF was Webb's organization now, and it was just as crooked, if not more so, as it had ever been. The growing parallels to the Cosa Nostra cases that Norris and the other prosecutors on his team were used to handling would have been striking, if anybody had bothered to take a look. Jack Warner had been safely ensconced in Trinidad since his sons were arrested. He hadn't breathed a word of the incident to anyone in the 5 months that had elapsed, and he radiated confidence in public, mocking the idea that he had ever done anything less than sparkling clean. But in truth, the walls were closing in. On April 20th, the day after CONCACAF released its integrity report detailing decades of Warner's corruption, Trinidad and Tobago's Prime Minister, Kamla Persad Bissessar, cut short a visit to Washington. She raced home to her private residence outside Port of Spain and convened an emergency Saturday afternoon cabinet meeting. Warner arrived in a pink and white guayabera and waited on the front porch, chatting with other ministers. A little after 4, he was received by Persad Bissessar. The two met in private for an hour, then Warner drove away without answering questions from reporters who were waiting outside. The seemingly endless string of scandals that dogged Warner had made him a highly controversial figure ever since his first cabinet appointment 3 years earlier. But he was chairman of the United National Congress, the country's most powerful political party, which controlled the ruling coalition that had put Persad Bissessar into power. He also sat on the country's National Security Council, which runs Trinidad's domestic and international intelligence operations. Although Warner was despised by some, he was enormously popular among his base and feared by other politicians, who worried about his vast capacity for blackmail and revenge. As a result, Warner was able to weather the global outcry over the Port of Spain bribery scandal, as well as his subsequent resignation from FIFA, CONCACAF, and the CFU. In fact, Warner's power at home seemed only to grow. Starting in February 2013, rumors began to swirl that Warner's sons, who had not been seen in Trinidad for months, were under house arrest in Miami. Warner, ever the cagey politician, refused to confirm or deny anything, stating he would not say anything until somebody is bold enough to print something or to say something. Then on March 27th, Reuters reporter Mark Hosenbald did just that, publishing an article claiming that Darian Warner had become a cooperating witness in an FBI probe into alleged corruption in international soccer. The article, which quoted an anonymous government official saying that it's shaping up like a major case, curiously did not mention Daryl Warner, but made clear that Jack Warner was a focal point of the investigation. It had been more than a year since anything about the case had been mentioned in the global press. Clearly sourced from directly within law enforcement, the new leak was exactly the kind of indiscretion that Norris, as lead prosecutor, had tried so hard to prevent. Public reaction in Trinidad was immediate and fierce, and cries for Warner's resignation rose from rival political parties and trade unions. But the Prime Minister said in a statement that she was reserving judgment and was awaiting corroboration of the information in the article from U.S. authorities before making any determination or pronouncement. The drumbeat grew louder when the Trinidad Express began to publish on April 14th a massive multi-part investigation into Warner's financial affairs, revealing decades of missing, possibly stolen money, diverted soccer player salaries, scalped World Cup tickets, and public deception. Yet on April 18th, the Prime Minister's spokesman insisted Warner enjoys the full support of every single member of the cabinet, noting that he is one of the most hard-working ministers in our cabinet, and we wish more people had that work ethic. The CONCACAF report, with all its specificity and detail, proved finally to be the last straw. Warner had become a public embarrassment and distraction for the administration, and was dominating conversation on the island. For his part, Warner said that the matter was of no concern to me, and as far as I am aware, it is baseless and malicious. The sun had long set on that spring Saturday when the Prime Minister finally stepped outside her residence to the glare of television lights and flashbulbs. Looking fatigued in a stylish red dress, she greeted the press with a tight smile. "I have accepted the offer of resignation from Jack Warner as Minister of National Security," Persad Bissassar said. 3 months later, Warner received a phone call from Trinidad's chief immigration officer, Keith Sampson, who asked for the return of the diplomatic passports he and his wife held. The island's foreign ministry, it turned out, had expected Warner to return the travel documents, along with his government-issued cell phone, keys, and computer, when he resigned. But he had not done so, and, according to local reports, pressure from the U.S. government had prompted a more urgent official request. On the phone, Warner asked for an extra week so he could transfer his American visas, issued the previous December, to a regular passport. 7 days passed, but Warner still had not handed over the documents. He did, however, publish in a political newspaper he funded a virulent screed against the government for daring to ask for the documents in the first place. Finally, on July 26, Trinidad's immigration department canceled the two passports. Warner's diplomatic immunity was stripped, and he could now be charged with a crime in the United States of America. Warner, defiant, told reporters he didn't care about the passport. He had no intentions of traveling overseas anytime soon. On April 29, 2013, just 10 days after CONCACAF aired its dirty laundry, FIFA's Ethics Committee published the long-anticipated results of its internal review of the ISL matter. Like the Swiss prosecutors before them, FIFA's ethics investigators found that the sports marketing firm had bribed officials at least since the early 1990s in exchange for soccer rights, including the World Cup. ISL had kept paying bribes up until its bankruptcy in 2001. Other than the ISL officials who actually paid the bribes, it wasn't clear that anyone knew how many FIFA officials had been on the company's dole. But in the end, it was corruption that killed it. The firm greased so many palms that it couldn't afford its above-board payments to FIFA and other sports organizations. ISL, for years one of the most powerful sports marketing firms in the world, had literally bribed itself into insolvency. A week before FIFA published its findings, the 96-year-old Avalanche, whom Blatter had made honorary president of FIFA for life when he stepped down in 1998, quietly resigned. Teixeira, for his part, had given up all his soccer positions in early 2012. Swiss prosecutors had found that the two men had taken at least $15 million from ISL over the years, but let them off after they paid back scarcely a third of that. FIFA, said Leos, meanwhile, had taken $130,000 from ISL in 2000, and may have gotten an additional $600,000 over the years. On April 24th, just 5 days before FIFA published its findings, he resigned as well. With all three men formally out of the game, FIFA closed its investigation on grounds that any further steps or suggestions are superfluous. Chapter 20. Leave Us Out of This. Soon after the turn of the 20th century, the Miami River was dredged, and the huge quantities of silt, sand, and limestone pulled from its bed were dumped into Biscayne Bay, creating two unsightly waste islands